You may be seated. Let's bring the lights up, and I want to invite you to turn to where we've left off. We are in the midst of the final chapters of the book of Acts, and for all of our remaining chapters, Paul is a prisoner. So we're going to find Paul as we enter into our story tonight, Acts chapter 22, verse 30, and then we're going to immediately be into verse 23 as we look at this religious rumble that's about to take place. With Paul as a prisoner, he's bound in chains. The Romans have him as a captive, and believe it or not, that's a good thing. Because if they didn't have him as a prisoner, his own countrymen, the Jews, would kill him. They would tear him to pieces. They want Paul dead. And because of that, it's a good thing that Paul is a prisoner in Roman custody. His own people have taken great issue with his deep association with Gentiles. They feel that he's compromised their deep and distinctive Jewish identity in doing so, and that he's undermined the law, and that he's undermined all they stand for. And so they find Paul to be an absolute threat that they want to not just silence, but to kill. And because they've tried to kill him a couple of times already, we thank God for the Roman soldiers who have no idea what they're doing, but they're the ones at this point keeping the Apostle Paul alive. And one of their questions is, what's this guy really done? I mean, why does everyone want to kill Paul? They cannot determine any kind of specific crime. They don't see anything that involves any accusation that is valid. And so since they can find no crime, they are in a conundrum into why Paul's own people want Paul dead. And so we're going to open our story with the Roman procurator who's going to convene a council, the tribune, the Roman soldier who's over all of this, trying to figure it out, to make sense of it. And in doing so, he's going to go straight to the source. He's going to go to the highest Jewish ruling council in Jerusalem. He's going to go to what we call the Sanhedrin. You can call them the ruling council. That's their official name, the Sanhedrin. And so beginning at verse 30, the next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priest and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. So Paul might for once get a fair hearing. I mean, you'd expect that out of the people who've ascended to the highest levels of leadership. You'd expect that out of those who claim to represent the high morals, the high standard, the high law, the high tradition of the Jewish faith. So Paul's going to encounter these people who are at the heights. They should be the elders, the mature and the wise. And so if you're Paul, you're probably hoping, finally, my peers, finally people who understand rabbinical teaching and know all the nuances and might be able to understand the argument I'm trying to present. And so Paul's expecting a reasonable, fair hearing, and you're going to find that that goes out the window after one sentence. Paul gets one sentence in before he is socked in the mouth and told to shut up, to know his place by the religious leaders, by the elders, by the ones committed to hold the tradition of Israel. So let's look at it. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, verse 1 of 23, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day. At this, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him in the mouth." So, my brothers, I have a clean conscience in what I'm doing. Pow! They slap him. We can imagine he falls to the ground. This is an attempt to silence him from the beginning. You got to ask yourself, what provoked this? I mean, look at what he said. "My brothers, I fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day." Those don't seem like fighting words. Those don't seem like the kind of words that a religious, devout, pious follower of Torah would take as so offensive it deserves violence. It deserves silencing. But that's what the high priest has decided. So if you look at what he says in verse 1, we might be able to discern what is so offensive. Maybe it's "my brothers." Maybe he's addressing them as peers, as equals, instead of not deferring to their superiority. That he should refer to them with a little bit more of a humility. Or maybe, and I think it's more likely this, "I fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience." I have a good conscience before God, which is Paul right from the starting gate saying, you know, you guys can judge me, You can accuse me. You can, you know, lay the strongest critical claim against me. I have a good conscience. I'm innocent before God. And so I think it's that that floats their boat. It's that which causes them to lash out, because Paul is saying to the assembly, you're not my ultimate judge. I stand before God and my conscience is clear. To which Ananias hears this and says, you have no right to announce your innocence. We'll decide that. We'll decide if you're innocent or not. We'll decide if this situation demands some kind of retribution. Not you, Paul. You're not the judge in this case. The point being, as we open this story, so much for a fair hearing. There's not going to be a fair hearing. And Paul is shrewd enough to know from this point on, whatever he says will not be heard. He is not going to be given in any way a fair treatment. And it'll explain the cat in the pigeon house he's going to throw out in just a moment. So Paul knows he's not going to get a fair hearing. In fact, he's not going to get much better treatment than he got from the mob who dragged him out of the temple and wanted to kill him. But Paul's just been hit in the mouth. And what do you do when you get hit in the mouth? Well, you lash out. At least I do. That's what you'd do, probably. The only one that we don't see doing that is Jesus, because the same thing happens to Jesus. Jesus gets struck in the mouth at the command of the high priest, and we'll look at his way of responding, which is a little different than Paul, because Paul's vicious. I mean, he's angry. So verse 3, Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to your law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. So Paul curses him. This is the cleaned up version. Paul is essentially saying, God blank you. And I don't say that, not because it's a bad word, but because that's what he's actually saying. May God be your judge. May God judge you for the misbehavior that you have just done. So he curses him, and then he explains why. You're a whitewashed wall. And we know that language from Jesus when he speaks to the Pharisees and says, you're like whitewashed tombs. But a whitewashed wall is even different. If a wall's rotten, and you want to not fix the wall, not deal with its impurity, but you just kind of want to cover over the rottenness, you whitewash it. And Paul's essentially saying, you're rotten to the core. You're rotten to the core, and you're covering up with your high priest vestments. And so he names the hypocrisy, and he says it in such a way that he then says, but I'm on the right. Because he says, you sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. You're going to judge me according to your law, and yet you yourself aren't keeping it from the very first sentence of this hearing. So, Paul's got some strong words to say. And that's going to lead this council to do what they do to Jesus about 20 or 30 years earlier. Verse 4, those who were standing near Paul said, you dare to insult God's high priest. Paul replied, brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest, for it is written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people. So he quotes from Exodus, says, I didn't realize. Now here's what's interesting. Many commentators and scholars say, really? Paul, you don't recognize him. And they assume that this isn't meant to be taken absolutely literally, but that Paul has some bitter, biting irony in what he's saying. And here's what may be going on here. Now, it could simply be that he really doesn't recognize him. It's been 20 years since he's been in Jerusalem. So perhaps he just doesn't recognize Ananias. Perhaps this council's been convened so quickly that Ananias hasn't had opportunity to put on his high priest vestments, so Paul doesn't have an awareness of who he is. But I find it more likely that Paul is speaking in this way. So you're high priest? Huh. I don't recognize a high priest in you. I don't see anyone acting like a high priest here. But since you are high priest, I'll keep the law. And the law says I'll respect your office. I'll respect the office you hold. But in that, there might be some biting irony. David Garland puts it the best. Before I show that, though, this is Jesus in the same situation. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest? So you see the echo? Same thing has happened to Jesus. Jesus, instead of saying, God blank you, says, if I said something wrong, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? Now that's good. Wish we could all be like that. I can't. If you struck me in the mouth, the first thing I'd have is about 5 to 20 expletives coming out after I said, "What? I thought you liked me." So you have some strange thing going on here, but Paul has been a little bit more brutal, but Paul is also recognizing he's not going to get a fair treatment. And so David Garland says, this may be what's going on. This admission, "I didn't know you were high priest," is more of an accusation than a confession of ignorance. It implies that no proper high priest would behave as Ananias did. How was Paul to know that he was a high priest? Ananias's behavior makes him unrecognizable. I think that that's perhaps more of what's going on. Well, that takes us to the second half of this hearing, which doesn't last long because Paul already has determined this won't be fair. I'm not going to get a fair hearing. Justice will not occur. Nobody's going to listen to my story. These people are just as unruly as the mob. They might have all of these high letters behind their name. They might have all this high responsibility among the people of Jerusalem, but they are just the same as the mob. They want me dead too. They're not going to listen to me. So Paul uses a rhetorical device called divide and conquer to throw a cat into the pigeon house. Are you familiar with that phrase? You know, you throw a cat into a pigeon house, trouble's going to happen. And Paul's got a cat to throw. And that cat he's going to throw in is resurrection. Because he knows the moment he mentions the word resurrection, the people in this council are going to be instantly divided. They are going to be in an uproar. So Paul is strategically at this point trying to get out of this situation. And so here's what he does. Verse 6. Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, Sadducees don't believe in resurrection. They only embrace the first five books of the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and Numbers. They do not believe that there's any resurrection after the dead, that there's no life after death. For them, the only way you perpetuate life after death is through your children. They also don't believe in spirits or angels. The reason the Sadducees don't believe in that is because they've just accepted the first five books, but even more than that, they're usually the wealthy and the elite in the community, and who needs an afterlife when this life's so good? Who needs to talk about, you know, the beauty of the world to come where God judges injustice and brings righteousness when you're kind of happy with the twisted system that you have negotiated to your advantage? You've worked it. You worked the system. So the Sadducees don't believe in resurrection. They don't believe in spirits, don't believe in angels. The minority are Pharisees. And knowing this, Paul called this out in the Sanhedrin. "My brothers, I am a Pharisee." Now he's playing his Pharisee card. Okay? Pharisee of Pharisees. What's interesting, Paul never completely looks at that as a negative, and we'll see that before we're done. "I'm a Pharisee. I was schooled by Gamaliel, the rabbi of the Pharisees, the chief Pharisaical rabbi. So brothers, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I have a long heritage. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. And now the cat is on the loose." Because Paul is not just trying to create, conquer, and divide. He's also trying to speak truth to power. And in doing this, he knows that the single most important word that makes a case for his faith is resurrection. So he's not just playing a game of strategy, conquer and divide, oh, he's doing that, but he's also throwing out his best cat, and the best cat is he is a Christian because he saw the risen Lord. He is a Christian because he believes that God will bring all things to their intended conclusion, that judgment will happen, evil will be undone, injustice will be broken. He believes that there's a future and it has to do with resurrection. And knowing that, he knows that the Sadducees, the majority, don't believe that. So listen to how the group responds. This is almost comical. When he said this, verse 7, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. There was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously, "We find nothing wrong with this man," they said. He's one of us. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him? So you see what Paul's done. He's not only conquered and divided, and now instead of them focusing all their violence and rage on him, they're focusing it on one another. He's also thrown out the most important cat, because he really does stand on trial, because he holds to the resurrection hope that the Pharisees hold on to. So the council is divided, and the Pharisees, the minority, end up saying, as you'd expect, yeah, we kind of like this guy. We get him. He's one of us. And, you know, what's wrong with believing in the resurrection of the dead, right, Sadducees? Nothing wrong with that, is there? The Sadducees are angry at that. And the Pharisees' language in verse 9 really inflames the situation. If you look at that again with me, we find nothing wrong with this man. Now listen to this. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him? Do you see how they're inflaming the situation? What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him? Well, the Sadducees don't believe in spirits or angels. I mean, they're just digging the hole deeper and saying, you know, you guys, this is why you can't believe this, because you guys deny this reality that our tradition actually embraces, but you guys have rejected it, which shows that you guys need to rethink your theology. And now there's a religious rumble going on, and Paul's work has been done. If you look at the phrases, like in verse 7, a dispute, at the end of verse 7, they were divided, verse 9, a great uproar. They argued vigorously. You get the sense that Luke, in writing this, is trying to show you everything's just come to shambles. I mean, it is just a mess. It's a shouting match that this is degenerated into, and old rivalries are provoked, and we're just on the edge of violence, which makes you feel bad in verse 10 for this poor Roman tribune, for this poor Roman commander who's just trying to figure out, what's up with Paul? Why don't people like Paul? Why are his countrymen against them? So you can imagine, here's this Roman tribune watching this. And verse 10, the dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring them in to the barracks. I can imagine the Roman tribune thinking things like, why is the high priest so offended that Paul has a clear conscience? Why is it when Paul said he had a clear conscience that he got punched? That seems odd. Why is this group that's supposed to be united in their sacred tradition, why are they so divided? Why does it take just one or two phrases to cause them all to be in an uproar? I mean, golly, you wouldn't see that in a Roman platoon. You wouldn't see that among my soldiers. And thank God for the soldiers in this story right now. They're keeping Paul alive. They are the ones that are preventing him from being torn apart by the religious rumble that's taking place. The religious rumble is so great that our Roman centurion, the commander, has to take Paul away, lest they tear him to pieces. And once again, no answers are given to what can we do with Paul. And instead, we find that the Romans are going to have to do something with him, and that's the remainder of our story. They're going to send him to Rome, which is where Paul wanted to go to anyway, but not in chains. But you can imagine Paul might be very frustrated at this point. You'd imagine Paul might be thinking, as I would be thinking, you know, I've come back to my people, they want to kill me. I've talked to religious leaders that I thought would at least give me a fair hearing, they want to kill me. The only people that want to keep me alive are the Romans. You can imagine Paul thinking, what's the use? I mean, this is going nowhere. This isn't going to in any way really further the gospel that I hold in such high esteem. And that is why we have verse 11 to close out our story. Because Paul has a vision, thank God, of the Lord Jesus. He must have needed it, as we oftentimes need to have a reassuring word. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul, said, take courage, which means he must have been feeling very afraid. As you've testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. Jesus says, I know you're discouraged. Take heart. And know this, Paul, you're going to get to Rome. It might not be an easy path. You've already seen how difficult this might be. But you will get to Rome. That will happen. And I'd imagine that must have encouraged Paul, at least in some sense of knowing with these chains, with these bonds, with this confusion, that he is on the path to where he's wanted to go, to the ends of the earth, that the gospel might be preached, not just in Jerusalem, not just Judea, not just Samaria, but that that might go to the uttermost parts of the world. So we're en route to that, but it took this religious rumble to get there. A couple of points of reflection and we'll be done. One of the things that I reflected on as I went through this is you really do expect, and I expect a lot out of particularly religious leaders, people who have risen and ascended to the heights, the echelons of representing their religious tradition, of trying to preserve and protect and pass on the faith. You would hope that those who are holding those high places would know that there's no place in our religious tradition to use our power to silence people we disagree with, particularly punching and wanting to kill them. That should be off limits. That shouldn't be part of what it means to have obtained the highest level of leadership in a religious tradition, that you use that power to silence and to punish. But that's what's happened. And because of that, poor Paul, who just was saved last week from a mob, really finds that this Sanhedrin's no better than the mob. Once again, the Romans must save him from those who say that they stand for the law, that say they stand for Moses and Torah. Once again, he must be saved, and thank God he's saved by the Roman military. Again, it's one of those strange things we realize right now, if we're on the sidelines listening to the story, there were some great challenges that the early church had with war and violence and military and all of that. But at the end of the day, right now, they're proving to be the just ones, the ones keeping it together, the ones that are making sure unjust violence doesn't occur. They don't know why, but they know they got to deal with this, and they're doing it with much greater integrity, much greater mercy than anyone in the religious community is doing. Robert Wall puts it this way: the leadership team of official Israel's in shambles, forever fighting among itself and without competence or patience to debate the merits of a case. The Sanhedrin is no better than a common mob. Both become violent and threaten to tear Paul to pieces because of their differences. And so the tribune in both cases must intervene and safeguard Paul. Could it be sometimes that the world is watching our denominational debates and our interchurch discussions with the same kind of odd curiosity and scratching their head that this Roman commander is, and saying, why can't these guys get along? I mean, don't they all believe that God is love and God's called us to peace and mercy and compassion and justice? What's wrong with these guys? And I think when we hear that, we need to sympathize with our Roman commander and say, well, sometimes the world may be more right than the church is. Sometimes they might have more of a sense of justice and righteousness than those in the highest levels of leadership in the religious community. Which brings me to the second point, where Paul doesn't seem to have any hesitation to speak truth to power. Paul respects the office of the high priest. He's not going to undermine it. But he doesn't respect the man holding that office in this case. He looks at Ananias and says, you're going to judge me and you don't even keep your law. I have some issues with you. But yet at the end of the day, that's all he can do. He can just call out and say, you know, you're doing wrong, and I do not see before me a real high priest. You're unrecognizable. And in that, we need to realize that Ananias was really a work of art. I mean, he was a mess. If you read Josephus, a historian of that day, Ananias hoarded money. He obtained favor through bribery. He robbed other priests of their tithes, forcing them to starve to death. He was more than willing to use theological differences to justify violence and brutality and even murder. So he was a piece of work that Paul, at this point, in recognizing he's not going to get justice, at least has the courage enough, even with irony, to speak truth to power. Then the final reflection, and this may be the most surprising for you, because we don't tend to talk like this when we study the Gospels. In the Gospels, Jesus interacts more than anyone else with the Pharisees. And we oftentimes create a caricature of the Pharisees that they are just such a mess, so legalistic, so bad. That must be why Jesus has them as his chief interlocutors. But the reason Jesus has them as the chief interlocutors are they are closest to his message of anyone in Judaism at that time. You know, I tend to argue with people that are just a slight bit different than me in perspective. If you're on a whole other side of the map as far as your perspective, I could care less what you, because we're never going to make any kind of discussions. But if you're my brother or my sister, we have the same parents and everything's similar, but you think this and I think that, them's fighting words. And that's what Jesus is doing in this case. And this is where you need to see that Luke is connecting by having Paul throw out the cat of resurrection to say, hey, Pharisees, I'm on your side. I believe in the hope you believe in, the resurrection of the dead, that God will bring all to justice, that judgment will come, that right will be rewarded and evil will be undone. I believe there's a future. I don't think life is just here in the moment and then you die and hope that your children carry on your name like the Sadducees do. I really believe that life matters and that the God who's created us loves us too much to lose us, and that even in the Pentateuch, which the Sadducees hold, they don't see the rest of the Old Testament as inspired, Jesus himself, when encountered by Sadducees, they said, hey, Jesus, what if a man marries a wife, and he dies, and then another man, and another man, and she has seven husbands, or it's seven wives, it's one of those two, so you have one person and seven spouses. Whose wife will she be in the resurrection? And Jesus sees right through that with the Sadducees and says, hey guys, here's your problem. Here's your problem. God is the God of the living, not of the dead. You might just only believe that the first five books are authoritative. Let me quote from them. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. At that time, they're dead. But Jesus says, God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. God holds them. God carries them. They are alive with God. God hasn't lost them or forgotten them. So there's your resurrection in the first five books Jesus wants to say to the Sadducees. And it's one of those rare moments he has with the Sadducees. His big moments are with the Pharisees because they're so much like him and his message has so much to correlate to what they hold dear that when there are differences, those differences are really amplified. This is why in the Sermon on the Mount, remember the phrase, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees, you'll not enter the kingdom of God. The wrong way to view that is, yeah, the Pharisees, they're no good, but it makes no sense. Jesus is saying, unless your righteousness surpasses the Pharisees, which is to say, that's a compliment. These guys are righteous. They're holy. They care about the law. They care about God. They care about the things of the scriptures and of our tradition. So he's actually calling them to a higher standard than the highest standard they have. Are you following me there? This is why I find it amazing that when Paul says, I'm a Pharisee, he's not saying this out of the corner of his mouth, you know, and also denying it at the same time. He has as the foundation of his faith, his Hebrew tradition. And it was when he saw the resurrected Jesus that the Pharisaical faith he had opened up to realize, you know, the resurrection I believe at the end of time, that resurrection has begun in Jesus, inaugurating the kingdom, bringing the Spirit, bringing the beginnings of this new age or this kingdom that God's bringing in, so that he sees it as this way of expanding his Phariseeism rather than denying it. And Luke sees that here as well. So hopefully this will change the way we read our Gospels. Hopefully this will change the way we think about when we think about, you know, there are those legalistic, bad, moral people out there. And then there's those of us who are in the Spirit and we're just, you know, free willing and free loving and we're just really the right ones. That's not how Paul views it. That's not how Jesus views it. He understands the Pharisees with all their strictness and rigidity, having a commitment to God's law and a commitment to God's justice in believing that God will bring all things to a good end by raising the dead and bringing things to judgment and righting wrongs and punishing rewarding rights. Does that make any sense? I hope it does a little, because Paul's more than willing to throw that out, and he doesn't throw that out just simply to really deny it. out of the other side of his mouth. Well, these are our final moments in Jerusalem. As we go to our next story next week, you'll realize that this is it. Paul will never be in Jerusalem again. He is going to be escorted from Jerusalem, having his people completely reject him, having the highest in leadership declare him as someone that is worthy of dying. These leaders will actually follow him into our remaining stories because they want to see him dead. So they're going to follow him on his path to Rome to try to use the law court to make sure the Romans know he needs to die. And it's sad to think that as Paul leaves Jerusalem, he leaves not a place where he can remember with fondness, but he leaves a place that is a place of a religious rumble. That is a place of bitter divide and disputes and anger. It's a place where people have used their religion to justify killing those they disagree with. What a sad thing for Paul. But of course, Jesus had already experienced the former thing with one key difference. Jesus died in Jerusalem. Do you know the reason Paul won't die in Jerusalem? Because he has another card to play. He's already played it. He's a Roman. And because he's a Roman citizen, he has the right to due process of the court. If he weren't a Roman citizen at this point, the Roman commander wouldn't be trying to do something with him. But because he's a Roman citizen and has the rights of a Roman, he is going to make it to Rome, which shows us the differences between Paul and Jesus. Jesus and Paul really have similar paths as far as their suffering. Jesus' story ends in Jerusalem. Paul's will end in Rome, with him being beheaded by Caesar. But at least he makes it to Rome. And the reason he makes it to Rome is because he's not just a Jew like Jesus. He is a Jew with Roman citizenship. So we'll see how that plays out for him in the upcoming stories. Would you pray with me?